Hi, Nens and Frabers, I'm Spider Robinson, and you've become hopelessly entangled in Spider on the Web number 37, a pod-supported user cast being narrowcast first and last, slow and fast from the home for the terminally confused, being brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike, be excellent to one another. Got some great music to bring you this week, thanks to Mr. Holger Peterson, a man who is redoubtable, no doubt, without a doubt, and that's what he's all about. Holger is familiar to all Canadian music lovers, if only for his incredible broadcasts every Saturday night on CBC Radio called Saturday Night Blues, a Canadian institution for decades now. He is equally beloved for his work as the founder, director, creator, owner, operator of Stony Plain Records, another Canadian institution, the home of roots music. I can't give you anything like Stony Plain's entire catalog because I've only got an hour here, but let me just sort of tap dance down it and give you some of the highlights, and then you can go to www.stonyplainrecords.com to fill in the rest. How about guys like Steve Earle, Ronnie Earle, Maria Muldaur, Long John Baldry, Professor Longhair, Ellen McElwain, Charlie Musselwhite, Jay McShann, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Otis Rush, Ian Tyson, Sylvia Tyson, Barrence Whitfield with and without Tom Russell, Tom Russell with and without Barrence, Jimmy Witherspoon, Kevin Bright, Doug James, Bobby Charles, Herb Ellis, Eric Bibb, and Leon Bibb, Elvin Bishop, and the following gentleman. Now, regular readers of my stuff will be aware I consider him the most lyrical guitarist alive, Mr. Amos Garrett. His new album, Get Way Back, is, I'm delighted to say, his masterpiece, a tribute to his favorite songwriter-singer Percy Mayfield, who wrote Hit the Road Jack, and countless other songs recorded by people like Brother Ray, Etta James, Bobby Bland, B.B. King, Johnny Adams, Jimmy Witherspoon, Mose Allison, and the late, great Long John Baldry. Now, here's a famous song Brother Ray made a meal of. Listen to Brother Amos turn it into a banquet. Percy Mayfield's immortal, Never Say No.
Baby, please don't walk out on me. I'll never hurt you, but someone else will really hurt you. So baby, please don't walk out on me. And honey, please stop being so mean to me. You know I really love you, 'cause I done proved that I love you. So baby, please stop being so mean to me. I gave you all my money, baby, and loving too. I done everything that a fool could do. Try and keep you happy and satisfied, 'cause I want you by my side. So baby, please don't say no to me. Not until you've heard my story, 'cause you just might like my story. So baby, please don't say no to me. Thank you. driving too. I've done everything that a fool could do. Try to keep you happy, satisfied, 'cause I want you by my side. So baby, please don't say no to me. I don't do you've heard my story, 'cause you just might like my story. Baby, please don't say no to me. Baby, please. Baby, please. Don't say no to me.
And while you're at it, baby, please don't say no to Bucky Berger on drums, Victor Bateman on string bass, Ken Whiteley on piano, my pal Ron Cassatt on the Hammond organs, Dave Babcock on tenor and baritone, and Alistair Elliott on trumpet. I'll be back with more from that particular musical conspiracy in just a few minutes, but first I would like to plug something in which I happen to have a financial interest, to wit, my novel Very Bad Deaths, currently available as a Bain paperback or as a Blackstone audiobook, from which I'm about to bring you some excerpts. Now, I've read you chapters from this book in previous podcasts, archived at my website if you missed them. Nearly every one of them constituted an extended flashback to the 1960s. Now, finally, we come to something a little closer to real time. Flash forward, 2003. Trembling on the Verge, Heron Island, British Columbia, Canada. Chapter 1. Yes, his words should have held my attention, but I was distracted by the sudden realization that my first assessment had been completely mistaken. He did not smell as bad as ever. He did not smell bad at all. He smelled just like most people, which is to say he had no detectable aroma of any kind. That first blast of stench when I'd opened the door had been completely imaginary, a product of memory association. I realized I was openly sniffing the air to confirm that, and was instantly mortified.
"It finally didn't help anymore,"
Xander Zuniniego said, as if replying to some remark I'd made.
"I got too sensitive."
His voice no longer sounded like that of Tweety Bird. It had deepened. It now sounded like the voice of Marvin the Martian, the little guy who wants to blow up Bugs Bunny and the Earth with his Illudium Q-36 explosive space modulator. I nodded, as if I understood what the hell he was talking about. I couldn't seem to get a handle on my thoughts. They careened around like a cloud of drunken gnats. "You want some coffee? Something to drink? Are you hungry? Do you still like Oreos? Come on in the house with me and we'll..."
"I'm fine."
"Can't believe it's really you," I said. "I heard you were dead."
"I nearly was. They almost had me. Playing dead was the only way I could get clear."
"Clear of who?" He looked at me. Charlie Sanders had looked at me that way 30 years and more ago. His expression had said, "If you really need me to tell you, you won't understand the answer."
"You know who,"
Sanders said. Instantly I was on the defensive. "No, I don't."
"You know,"
he insisted.
"You knew when you heard I was dead."
My heart was hammering. How would I know?
"You knew most of it 30 years ago. You put the rest together thinking about it later. By the time my death was announced, it didn't surprise you much at all."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, Lim, you do."
Mouth dry, breathing fast and shallow, knees trembling. "God damn it, Zooty, you show up here without knocking after 30 fucking years, and the first thing you do, you..." He laid hands on me, physically touched me, grabbed me by the lapels of my shirt hard enough to pop a button. He had never touched me before, or anyone to my knowledge.
"Did you hear what I said when I came in the door?"
he shouted. That cartoon voice shouting was ludicrous, but I didn't laugh, because he had his hands on me, and because, yes, I had heard what he'd said when he came in. He had asked me to help him prevent the rape, torture, and murder of a whole family. That was serious? For real?
Serious enough that you don't have time to waste on denial, okay?
He said and let go of my shirt.
I know you are a good man. Everybody knows you're smart, but I know how smart you really are. I know how much you hate to admit the existence of anything you can't explain, but I also know you've had it proven to you that such things exist. That there are things in this world, in this life, you'll never be able to explain.
Reluctantly, I nodded.
So deal with it!
You want to dump something spooky on my lap? He nodded.
And if you can think of a better lap to move it to, great.
I closed my eyes for a second. The worst thing was I did know what he was talking about, sort of. I didn't want to, but I did. He was absolutely right. Over the last 30 years, I had been working it out in the back of my mind. I knew what he was, and I didn't want any part of it. When I opened my eyes again, they met his. The years melted away, and it was once again the afternoon we met, and those moist eyes were staring right into mine, just as they had back then. Forgiving me. Unconditionally. Blanket absolution for anything I'd ever done or left undone, and whatever I was about to do. For everything I'd said or left unsaid or might say in future. For who I was, and who I could have been but wasn't, and whomever I might become. I was aware of my breath and pulse slowing. With each breath, my shoulders settled a little lower. It was way too late to lock the barn door, and nothing was going to be stolen anyway. There was nothing left to steal. With an effort, I broke eye contact.
Let's go in the house.
I'd rather not.
I was surprised.
Well, there's no good place for you to sit down in here, and nothing to eat or drink. We can...
It would be too noisy in there for me,
he said. I understood what he meant at once. I didn't want to admit that either. He was right, too. I sighed.
Well, I've got to have some coffee if we're going to be talking about this kind of shit. Take my desk chair there. I'll bring another out for me. Coffee for you?
No, thanks.
You sure? If you like coffee, even a little, well, mine's special.
Another time,
he said in a tone of voice that suggested the other time would post-date the glaciation of hell.
Anything? Tea, soda, juice, 30-weight oil?
No hits, not even a smile on the last one.
Well, at least take some water. It's pure.
He nodded.
I'll share water with you.
I shot him a quick look. Was he referencing Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land? Impossible to tell from his bland, baby Huey face. I left him there and went in the house and made coffee. It didn't take much time or require any of my attention. A German radio baron was once so pleased by something he read in a column of mine that he sent me, out of the blue, as a token of his appreciation, a Jura Espressa, the Scalavario model. It is a Swiss machine, the size of a portable TV, and requires a converter the size and weight of a truck battery to operate on Canadian wall current. It lists for $2,000 U.S., very roughly 2,700 Canadian, and it is worth every damn penny. It makes the best possible coffee instantly. You keep it loaded up with a couple of liters of water and half a pound of coffee beans. That's it. Anytime you push the go button, it grinds some beans, makes coffee by the French press method, dumps the grounds into a hopper for disposal, and rinses itself. Once a week or so, you empty the hopper. That and keeping it stocked with beans and water are the total work involved. So making superb coffee was a matter of pushing a button and waiting for the cup to finish dripping. The aroma of fresh ground filled the room while I wrestled with myself inside my head. I saw my cat horse feathers sprawled on the living room floor, staring at something invisible in midair, tracking it as it moved across the room. Could I say for sure there was nothing really there? Everywhere I looked, just out of my peripheral vision, were little ghostlets of Susan. Was I absolutely positive they were imaginary? Not 5 minutes ago I had been planning my suicide. Did it matter where this craziness might lead me? If you believe only in reason and empirical truth and the material world, no wonder Susan hasn't contacted you from beyond, you dumb shit.
The coffee finished dripping. I stirred in some sugar. I got cream and a half-liter bottle of filtered water from the fridge. I put some cream in my coffee and put the rest away again. I started to take my coffee and his water back out to the office, but before I was two steps out of the kitchen, I stopped and backtracked. I tipped half an inch of coffee out into the sink and replaced it with brandy. Before resealing the brandy, I took a big, fiery gulp and coughed. Then I put away the bottle and brought my coffee and Xander's water and a folding chair out to the office. I set my coffee mug down on a bookshelf and turned my back on him to set up the chair. As I was doing so, without warning, I tossed the plastic bottle of water back over my left shoulder in his general direction. I finished arranging the chair to my satisfaction, retrieved my coffee, and when I turned around and sat, he was just as I had left him, except that he was drinking water now. The sudden appearance of a flying bottle of water had startled him not at all. "You're right," I said. "I thought about it a long time. And you're right, I did figure out a few things. I know the three most important things about you. I'm not so sure I didn't know them back at St. Billy Joe." He waited. "You read minds." He nodded. "There's no off switch." He nodded again. "And it hurts." He sighed and nodded a third time.
"Christ, yes. More than I can tell you."
"Holy shit." "Well," I said, "I was going to ask how you managed to track me all the way across a continent, but I guess that wouldn't be too much of a challenge for—"
"I didn't have to track you anywhere," he interrupted. "I was here when you got here. For the last 20 years I've been living on Coveney Island."
"Extremely holy shit. The coastal waters of southwestern British Columbia are overgenerously supplied with islands, ranging from the Leviathan Vancouver Island, nearly twice the size of Massachusetts, all the way down to Coveney, which is about twice the size of the average high school grounds. It made my little island of 3,000 souls seem like metropolis. There was no ferry service to it at all, not even a foot passenger-only water taxi, as far as I knew, and until now I had believed it to be uninhabited. If Xander lived there, he owned a boat. And must be uncommonly skilled in its use. Even horny teenagers tended to avoid Coveney Island because there was no easy place to come ashore and no beachfront. I only knew of its existence because the ferry between Horseshoe Bay and Heron Island passed near it, and I once idly asked the ferry crewman if it had a name. It was basically just a lumpy rock bristling with trees. From a certain angle, if the light was right, it looked like a sleeping green hedgehog. I could not recall ever seeing chimney smoke rising from it, or a boat moored there."
We interrupt this chapter for another musical slice of Amos Garrett's tribute to Percy Mayfield, "Get Way Back." This track is called "Stranger in My Own Hometown."
I'm like a stranger, a stranger in my own hometown. I'm like a stranger in my own hometown. Some folks that I've known since my childhood don't seem to want me round. Don't want me around. I came home with good intentions about 5 or 6 years ago, but my hometown won't accept me. I don't feel welcome here no more. I'm just like a stranger in my own hometown. I'm like a stranger, stranger in my own hometown. Thank you.
hilltop. You see, I'm a family man. I work hard in my kind of business and do the very best I can. Now I don't mistreat nobody. They're a liar if they say I do. Well, there are some here who like me, but they are so very few. I am a stranger, stranger in my own hometown. My so-called friends stop being friendly, but you can't keep a good man down. You can't keep him down.
Another of the true giants on Holger Peterson's Stony Plain Records label is Mr. Duke Robillard, one of the great blues guitar players of all time. W.C. Handy Awards have named him Best Blues Guitarist 2 years in a row. B.B. King called him one of the great guitar players, and the Houston Post called him one of God's guitarists. None of these people are overstating the case. Duke comes from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. In 1967, he formed Room Full of Blues and never looked back. Before you know it, he was replacing Jimmy Vaughan in the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and then one day he met Holger Peterson at the Winnipeg Folk Festival, and real good things started to happen. Since then, he's cut a couple albums with Jimmy Witherspoon, a couple with Jay McShann, albums with Billy Boy Arnold and Roscoe Gordon, a couple with the Rockin' Highliners, and in fact, an album guitar duets with jazz legend Herb Ellis. And some more stuff we're going to get to later on. But first, I would like to play you a couple of tracks from his next Stony Plain album, A Swingin' Session.
I've gotten down to my last pair of shoes. Can't even win a nickel bet. Because them that got is them to guess, and I ain't got nothing yet. I'm sneaking in and out on my landlord. All I seem to do is stay in debt, because them that got is them to guess, and I tell you, I ain't got nothing yet. Now that old saying, them that's got is them that gets, is something I can't see. If you gotta have something before you can get something, how'd you get your first is a mystery to me. I see folks with long cars and fine clothes. That's why they call the smarter set, because they manage to get whatever them has got the sports to get, and I ain't got nothing yet. We'll be right back.
not that old saying, them that's got is them that gets, is something I can see. If you gotta have something before you can get something, how'd you get your first is still a mystery to me. I see folks with long cars and fine clothes, that's why they're called the smarter set, because they manage to get whatever them that's got is supposed to get. You got it. I ain't got nothing yet. Say, I sure could use a dollar for a cup of coffee. A fish sandwich wouldn't be too bad. Oh, come on, Roland, help me out. You know I ain't got nothing yet. Must be coming soon. When do I get mine? You know, I just don't understand. I do everything I can, and still, I ain't got nothing yet. Nothing seems to be going my way.
Well, your luck is about to change for the better, Duke, because here is some more of Very Bad Deaths.
And basically what you've been doing there all this time, I said, is hiding out from the CIA, right? He didn't flinch.
And the FBI, the NSA, Treasury, CIS, the Horsemen, Interpol. Yeah, they're part of what I've been hiding from.
Jesus, who else is there to hide from?
Everybody.
Oh.
Back in college, I could stand having most people as close as 10 or 20 meters away from me. Smelling terrible helped keep them outside that range. But it also made me noticeable and memorable.
I noted that he'd said meters instead of yards. He had been in Canada longer than I had. I also distinctly recalled that he had seemed comfortable having me within a meter or two of him for long periods back then. I decided to be flattered.
You should be,
he said.
But now,
for the first time, I noticed lines on his face that hadn't been there in college. A lot of them.
Ah, Christ, being within 100 meters of just about anybody is agony now. My range and sensitivity have both increased to where there's just no point in smelling bad anymore. It doesn't keep people far enough away. And being that noticeable stopped being good strategy anyway.
He had one of those 1,000-yard stares.
It became time to bail out of the world. Or end up chained up somewhere in Langley, or the Pentagon basement, or RCMP headquarters. As I said, they very nearly got me.
So you jungled up on Coveney. Jesus. How did you know I was here on Heron?
You mention it in your column sometimes. I tracked you from there.
You can't get the Globe and Mail on Coveney Island. Hell, I'm the only person on this island who gets it home delivered, and only because I'm on staff.
I read it online.
Suddenly I felt myself blush.
Yeah, that's right,
he said.
All those years ago, every time you called me Xander, inside you were thinking smelly, and every time I knew it, big deal.
What was there to say? I was busted. I'm sorry, man, really. He waved it away.
Don't worry about it. Most people called me smelly to my face. I appreciated you taking the trouble. Just like I appreciate the fact that you haven't once thought of me as smelly since you realized I'm not anymore.
I blushed again.
Oh, look, don't worry about it, I said. Zooty is fine.
Well, Xander just sounds like the name of the secret agent in an episode of General Hospital to me. He nodded.
My uncle used to call me Zooty when I was a boy. I kind of like it.
Pause.
No, really, Russell.
I finished my coffee and set down the mug. All right, Mr. Sensitive Mind Reader, you probably know my situation as well as I do, right?
Better.
You poor bastard. Okay, fine. So what's wrong with me that you need to fix? Grief? How the hell do you fix grief? He didn't hesitate.
You're in deep clinical depression.
Oh, horseshit, I don't believe in depression. The modern equivalent of witchcraft, complete with a magic potion. He continued as if I hadn't spoken.
You're about 2 days from suicide, maybe less. I don't need to be a mind reader to know that.
Oh, yeah? What was your first clue, Dr. Freud?
You haven't asked me a word about the family who are going to be butchered. You haven't wondered about them. For all you know, they're neighbors of yours. Your heart is switched off. Your soul is shut down.
The strangest thing happened to me. Without warning, I found myself crying, sobbing full out, except no water came out of my eyes. I cried dry, I thought. I cried dry.
What are you doing, counting in German? He asked.
I was startled enough to giggle in the midst of my crying. In all the time I'd known him, I could not recall Xander Zuniga ever attempting a joke, let alone a pun, much less a multilingual pun.
You know why shrinks love to see a patient come in the door with clinical depression? He asked me.
I shrugged. Nonviolent? He shook his head.
Nearly all their patients are nonviolent.
I shrugged again. Why then?
It makes them feel effective. There are about 1,000 things that can go wrong in the functioning of a human brain. Depression is the only one that can, to 95% certainty, be completely cured by prescribing a pill.
Horseshit, I said again. And again he ignored me.
The trouble is, you have to take them for at least a couple of weeks before they start to kick in. We don't have that kind of time.
Oddly annoying dilemma. If you're crying, but no water is flowing, what are you supposed to do? Pat your cheeks with an imaginary tissue? Well, that's easy, I said. You're a telepath. Just wander around until you find somebody who's got a time machine, and that...
Do you trust me, Slim?
And that way all we have to do is say what?
Do you trust me?
What do you mean?
I mean, do you trust me?
I wasn't crying anymore. That's not a simple question, Xander.
Yes, it is.
Well, in what sense? Are you asking, do I trust you not to boost anything while I'm in the house making coffee? Or do I trust you're not an Al-Qaeda mole? Or do you mean, do I trust you never to be mistaken about anything? Those shiny eyes bored into mine.
You know that I walk around inside your head, privy to your innermost secrets. Yet you have made no attempt to kill me. So I know you trust me to that extent.
Well, I know you can't help walking around inside my head. You'd stop if you could.
You know that because I told you.
I lifted an eyebrow. Good point. After a moment, I lowered the eyebrow. You're right, I must trust you. Hell, we lived together once. Yeah, I do trust you.
Everybody is at least a tiny bit telepathic. In your heart of hearts, you know I mean you no harm.
I looked around for my heart of hearts, but couldn't locate it. So I thought instead. Yes. Yes, I do. He took a long drink from his water bottle and twisted the cap back onto it.
All right. You trust me to wander around inside your head. Next step. Do you trust me to make a few small changes while I'm in there? The equivalent of,
he glanced down,
straightening up a desk just a little before everything in it lands on the floor.
I stared. Sue, do you think you can really do that? Like instant Prozac by Vulcan mind meld?
More like one of the tricyclics, he said, but yes.
I couldn't decide how I felt about it, which I realized was weird. All my life, the very idea of this kind of mental invasion of someone else making alterations in my personal mind had been a special horror of mine, featuring in some of my worst nightmares. Tonight I was so apathetic, so burned out I couldn't seem to give a shit anymore. There was just enough of me left to realize intellectually how alarming that ought to be. But my intellect got hung up on the absurdity of doing something that should frighten and revolt me, in order to regain the power to be frightened and revolted again. I would know it was working if I found myself starting to freak out.
It won't be like that,
he said, not arguing, just furnishing information.
Will it? No, it won't hurt, I promise.
Will I? He looked mildly exasperated.
How can I know that before the fact? There's no telling what people will decide to regret after the fact.
I couldn't argue with that. Well, have you?
Yes, I have. A total of 6 times so far.
After enough time had passed, I said gently, You know my next question.
He sighed and nodded.
Of course. 3 of the 6 were reasonably happy with the changes I had made. Another was wildly happy. But 1 was angry and over time learned how to undo everything I'd done.
Huh.
How long? It took him about a month.
More silence. I didn't prompt him this time.
The 6th killed herself,
he said when he was ready. Ah, I said.
Yeah,
he said and sighed heavily. I thought about it. So if I let you do this, the spectrum of possible reactions runs from I get really high to I kill myself?
Well, on the plus side, I suppose it's possible you could achieve true enlightenment and become the next Buddha, but basically that's it, yes.
Whip it out, I heard myself say.
You're sure?
Bring it. Either of those is way better than where I'm at now. He got up, wheeled my chair out from behind my desk and into the center of the room, and made me sit in it. He turned out the desk lamp, leaving my Mac the only significant light source in the room. He moused around that until he located iTunes, opened it, and activated its visual display. The screen exploded into psychedelic lunacy whose nature, colors, and speed changed constantly. My eyes were drawn to it and found it hypnotic. He pulled his chair beside mine, sat facing me. I offered him my hands, palms up, but he waved them away. Is there anything special I should be thinking, I asked, or thinking about?
Ideally, he said, you should be not thinking at all. Not even thinking about not thinking.
Well, terrific. How long does that take to learn? He spread his hands.
It varies. Some Buddhists spend their whole lives working on it, very hard, and never achieve it.
Wow, I said.
Just watch the screen.
Okay. And then, without thinking about it, I stopped thinking about anything at all.
And now to induce that same effect in you for at least 3 minutes, here is the great Duke Robillard with another track from his upcoming Stony Plain CD, A Swingin' Session. The song is ended.
The song is ended, but the melody lingers on. You and the song have gone, but the melody lingers on. The night was splendid, and the melody seemed to say, summer will slip away. Take your happiness where you may. There, beneath the light of the moon, we sang a love song that ended much too soon. The moon descended, and I found at the break of dawn, you and the song have gone, but the melody lingers on. Too soon.
The moon descended, and I found at the break of dawn, you and the song have gone. But the melody lingers on. Yes, the melody lingers on.
One of Duke's numerous other incarnations is in a swing jazz guitar trio known as New Guitar Summit. The other two guitarists in question being Jay Giles, who many of you will know from his work with the Jay Giles Band as a rock guitarist, and Mr. Jerry Beaudoin, who goes back so far he used to play with Eddie Cleanhead Benson, for Christ's sake. The Stony Plain catalog already includes their first CD, New Guitar Summit, and a DVD called Live from Stoneham Theater, both superb. The new album is about to come out, and I'm sorry to say I'm not absolutely positive what the name of the damn thing is. The copy I was sent is so advanced that information is a little obscure. I believe it is Flying Home. I may not be correct, but I'm sure if you camp out at the StonyPlainRecords.com website long enough, that confusion will be resolved. Meanwhile, here is its opening track, Little Bitty Pretty One.
Chapter 2.
It didn't work, I said.
No?
Hell no. I still have my grief. All of it. I mean, it hurts just as much as it did an hour ago. God still sucks. Nothing's changed.
Ah.
I don't feel any different at all. I opened up my eyes, and there he was beside me, looking at me with no expression. The screen display on my computer had been shut down. I snorted. Look who I'm telling. You probably know it better than I do. He shrugged.
Well, I tried.
Now, what about this family? Where are they? How many? And who wants to kill them? What are you smiling about?
Nothing.
Why can't we just go to the police?
Well, maybe we can. I can't.
What do you mean? He frowned.
Russell, I've known you for a long time. I've always liked you, and I still do. You have an unusually tolerant and sensitive mind, a kind heart, and a gentle disposition. You can stand next to someone you know is reading your mind and not want to kill him. After all this time, you remembered I like Oreos. I can't think of anybody I'm more comfortable with.
His frown deepened to the point of becoming a grimace.
And I can barely stand to be this close to you. I'll have to go soon.
Oh.
You were only part right before. Reading minds doesn't just hurt. It degrades. It forces you to know things that you know you're not supposed to know. I came here in the dead of night, and even then I almost didn't make it. You have no idea how loud some people can dream, Russell. But in daylight, forget it. I'd have been catatonic before I got halfway here. And this is a sparsely populated island of peaceful rural people. If I were to try and make it to a city police station, let alone walk inside it, or even get within a few hundred meters of a single beat cop...
He shuddered.
Some kinds of mind it hurts me even to think about. Cops are high on the list.
You could call them. I'm sure you don't have a phone out there in company, but you're welcome to use mine.
Think that through.
Okay. I'm a police desk sergeant. Someone calls up and wants to report a whole bunch of murders that haven't happened yet. He won't say how he knows about them. He has no hard evidence. He won't come in and be interviewed. He won't say why not. He'd rather not give out his address. He says his name is Xander Zudenigo, and he sounds like Marvin the Martian.
Click.
Okay, I said. Let's start over. Who? I stopped and thought for a moment. No, let's start at the beginning, if we can locate it. When did you first become aware something was wrong? He nodded.
That's the right way to approach it, I think.
I'm a columnist. I know where the lead belongs. He paused a moment to collect his thoughts, or perhaps to consult his memories.
Okay. I selected my home for privacy, for obvious reasons, and it usually works pretty good. Strangers almost never get near enough to come to my attention, and when they do, there's always plenty of warning, because they have to come slowly, by boat, picking their way through the shallows. A seaplane won't take off or land near Covenant because the water's too treacherous there. So if a plane does pass overhead, it's high up enough to be way out of my range. All of which is just to explain why I was taken so completely aback when suddenly there was a monster in my head one night. For a horrid second, I almost believed I had invented him, which would make me one sick fuck.
I stared. I had never heard Xander use the word fuck, not even in the worst of the 60s.
But a second later I realized what was going on. See, maybe that's a clue. In that first instant of contact, who he was more important to him, more prominent in his thoughts than what was happening to him. Which is amazing because as far as he knew, he was dying. His seaplane was going down, fast and shallow, some mechanical defect I understood perfectly just then and can no longer remember how to explain. As I became aware of him, he was already passing over my head about 30 meters up. And I agreed with him. Who he was a lot more interesting than his imminent death. Certainly way, way more horrifying. He was... monstrous.
Xander caught himself and paused.
No, he said, I'm not saying this right. You're picturing a combination of Ted Bundy, Bela Lugosi, or an Arnold Schwarzenegger. This guy is 1,000 times worse. What makes him terrifying isn't even so much what he wants to do. It's how small a thing it is to him.
As I thought of opening my mouth, he said,
You're right, I'm rambling. Sorry. Okay, if I'm going to convey it, I'm going to have to confront it. God, I hate this.
He closed his eyes, let his features go slack. In repose, his face looked like that of a pouting, remarkably ugly baby. After a moment, he took a deep breath and continued.
A guy is in your head, has no idea you exist. He's about to die. He knows that. He's been dealing with that for over a minute already, and it's coming up on showtime. Is he making his peace? Gibbering in fear? Trying to bargain with God? No, not this guy. He's laughing, contemptuously. He's thinking, "You think you can scare me into believing in you again? Screw you! I would have killed 1,000 if I had more time. Worse deaths than anything even you've ever dreamed of. I'd do it now if I could. A terrific one planned for next week. Do your worst, Yahweh, old boy. You'll vanish the instant I do."
He opened his eyes and sought out mine.
"You see? What he's got left is measured in seconds, and he's using them to congratulate himself on remaining atheist. I'm not selling out his intellectual integrity for even a few seconds' final comfort at the end of a life of psychotic savagery. And how does he do that? By telling an imaginary god to go chase himself, and throwing mortal sins in his face. That's funny to him."
He broke eye contact, looked down at the floor.
"And then, whatever it was, a plugged fuel line, that was it, just fixed itself at the last possible moment. He got enough control back to get the nose up, hit the water hard, skipped back into the air like a flat rock, and a few seconds later he was out of my range. I've been trying ever since to come to terms with what I learned during those 20 or 30 seconds I was connected to him."
He swiveled his chair, turning his back to me, and gripped his upper arms as if he were hugging himself.
"All right," he said, responding to what I had been thinking of saying. "I still haven't gotten to it. I know. Okay?"
"If you like," I said, "I can go take a nap and you can tell me later how this conversation came out." He turned back around to face me, still clutching his biceps.
"His first name is Alan. I don't know any others. He wrote a piece of software only programmers have ever heard of that made him roughly as wealthy as Alberta. He never has to work again and never will. His hobby takes up all his time these days. His hobby..."
He closed his eyes, took a deep breath, let it out.
"His hobby is suffering."
"Sounds like me," I said. His eyes snapped open and captured mine.
"Not experiencing suffering. Causing it."
"Jesus."
"Studying it. Cultivating it. Learning how to maximize it. Refine it. Enhance it. Prolong it."
"I don't understand," I said. "What kind of suffering?"
"All kinds," he said. "Every kind. Physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, philosophical. I really don't think he discriminates."
"But how?"
"If you were to meet him within 2 minutes' conversation, Alan would know what you fear the most. Within 4, he'd know who you love most and what it is they most fear. Within 5 minutes, he could make you burst into tears by speaking a single sentence, and probably would for the pleasure of your embarrassment. But the moment he laid eyes on you, he would already know just about everything there is to know about how to make your particular body experience maximum physical agony. That's a given."
"What the—"
"He could, for example, dig the second joint of his index finger into a certain spot on your body, not hard, certainly not hard enough to break a shortbread cookie, and make you beg him to kill you."
"Oh, bullshit."
"No."
He shook his head.
"And that's first grade stuff. He's a PhD. He's been studying this subject for a long time, as long as he can remember, really. Suffering is to Alan what art or music or literature are to others, and he is a gifted artist, a once-in-a-generation talent."
"So what are you saying? He's like a serial killer, Hannibal Lecter?" His shoulders slumped.
"Killing is about the kindest thing he does. He puts that off as long as possible."
"Well, how many is he?"
"I don't know exactly. Enough that he's lost count. Many dozens. Somewhere in the general neighborhood of 150.
I heard a loud buzzing sound. I could feel a headache coming on, and my stomach was cramping. Dear Jesus God.
"Russell, you have to help me stop him."
"Me?" I felt my jaw drop. "What the hell can I..." He overrode me, hard to do with that voice.
"Listen to me. Let me give you just one single small example of why this man has to be erased from the planet at once. Alan buys gas masks by the crate.
Gas masks?
Vintage World War I and II gas masks. He especially likes the ones that cover the whole face if he can get them.
I don't...
That way, when he sets someone on fire, they don't get to have a nice, quick, merciful death from smoke inhalation or scorched lungs. They remain conscious long enough to feel themselves...
Jesus Christ, that's enough!
A short silence ensued, in which I tried to wrap my mind around what he'd just said.
What is it you're asking me to do? I said finally.
Did you ever read a Larry Niven novel called Ringworld?
I shook my head.
Mistake. Well, in Niven's universe, there's an alien race. Giant cats, very vicious and aggressive. So aggressive that in their wars with humanity, they always lose because they always attack too soon. Anyway, they're so xenophobic they refuse to concede that any other race is truly sentient. So the title they give to their ambassador to the human race translates literally as Speaker to Animals.
I smiled. Nice phrase. I like it. You're saying that he's that ferocious an alien?
No. I'm saying I want you to be speaker to cops.
My smile went away. I retrieved the mental movie I had created earlier of Zudi calling the cops and replayed it, this time with myself in the starring role. It actually got less funny.
Well, that'll do for this week. I'm happy to announce that at press time, Ace recording engineer Rob Bailey and I have just finished the final edits requested by Blackstone Audio on their audiobook recording of Stardance by Spider and Gene Robinson, which should therefore be out and available any time now, to be followed very swiftly by Starseed and Starmind, both of which are already in the can as well. And please don't forget that in June, Bane Books will bring out the sequel to Very Bad Deaths, Very Hard Choices, in hardcover. And now to play us out, here's the new Guitar Summit, Flying Home. Take it, Duke, Jay, and Jerry. Thank you all very kindly for your PayPal subscriptions, donations, and good thoughts generally. Please come back next week for Spider on the Web number 38. Remember, without you, I'm just a guy talking to himself.